thank you very much. I wanted more enthusiasm when you heard about the vast size of this new book that, teacher, I'm going to assign to you after to read following this class, about a year following this class. But job in writing about semiconductors took me entirely by surprise. I went to the Rosen Letter to attempt to persuade him to give me a free subscription. It cost some $400. And before I left the office, they hired me. And so I agreed to do it because I have spent much of the last year learning about how new technologies get introduced, and with a specific focus on the semiconductor industry, the chips, which are the driving force in most of the leading technologies of the day, and which increasingly the Atari Democrats are celebrating as a reason for larger government involvement in the economy. And I thought if the Democrats were going to start talking about technology, I should understand it. So I've really devoted my entire last year to learning this technology and to demonstrating the real sources of economic growth and technological progress. But before I get to that theme, I think I should address for at least a couple minutes question to which I've been assigned today, this question of conservative ideas and conservative consequences. Certainly, we cannot assume that conservative ideas will have conservative consequences. Certainly, the results of liberal ideas should give us a deep sense of caution on that point. For I think the most significant event of the last couple years is the final and complete collapse of the moral pretensions of liberalism and socialism. It is absolutely clear today that planning breeds chaos. That's one of the major insights, of course, of Hayek, and it's become utterly manifest in American life. It's probably most obvious in the ghetto. And I've talked about this subject for many years, and I won't address it much more deeply, except to say that today it now becomes evident that liberal policy toward the poor is vicious and destructive. And let no liberal talk to you about compassion in the face of the wreckage that has been created in all our inner cities of America today. And the situation is worse, gets worse every year that these programs are extended. And anybody who cites these programs as evidence of compassion or offers any indication that they have promise of success gives first evidence of mendacity, because it's no longer possible to argue that they work. The illegitimacy rate among blacks in America has now reached 55%. This is the latest census figures. And since middle-class blacks have no greater propensity to have illegitimate children than middle-class whites, this is totally the result of welfare policy in the inner city. And the liberal ideas have paved a road to hell for the citizens of our ghettos. And liberals should never be allowed to forget that. Of course, they do have some further proposals to alleviate this problem of illegitimacy, and it's worth, which really represents total family breakdown. And since the family is the basic source of all economic growth and progress, this wreckage of the black family in the name of redistributing incomes extends and perpetuates and intensifies poverty. But nonetheless, folks at the Ford Foundation and elsewhere will tell you that the response to this problem is more liberalism, you know, more abortions, more sex education, more family planning clinics, more social workers, general expansion of the onslaught on the poor of America. But before anybody considers even entertaining any of these ideas, and I'm afraid many Republicans as well as Democrats are vulnerable to this kind of argument, it's worth considering just quickly the harvest of these programs in Sweden. Because Sweden for 25 years has had in effect all the entire liberal agenda for the poor of America. And it's worth considering their latest statistics and before one entertains any of the new proposals. In Sweden, the illegitimacy rate has now reached 40%. They've had, for 25 years, they've had sex education from the age of six. They've had contraceptives on every corner. They've had abortions on demand. They've had the whole array of family policy and socialism. And the result today of these policies is an illegitimacy rate of 40%. And this rate, UN statistics, occurred despite the fact that half of all pregnancies in Sweden under the age of 25 end in abortion. And this is, moreover, their divorce rate is 60% higher than ours. Our divorce rate is a catastrophe, but their divorce rate is 60% higher. And if you imagine their economic policies have been any more promising, they've adopted, too, all the economic policies advocated by the left in America, all the industrial policies and technology promotion programs you can imagine have already been in effect in Sweden for decades. And the Swedes now have reached the point where their deficit is 12% of GNP, despite the fact that their top marginal tax rate is still over 90%. So the idea that higher taxes or more socialism can have any beneficial impact, as well as liberal social policy can have any compassionate result, is completely refuted by the experience in Sweden. And people who will not face those statistics can, I think, give up any claim to be able to speak about the needs of American families. Well, this is, so it's quite clear that liberal policies are do not necessarily have liberal consequences, if you wish. But we certainly can't assume that conservative ideas have conservative consequences. There's some that I can think of that have afflicted the Reagan administration for some time, like the idea that higher taxes can reduce the deficit, the idea that the pursuit of a balanced budget is an effective way to manage government policy when the perpetual result is higher tax rates and slower economic growth. But I want to end on a more positive note, so I'd like to point to two conservative policies that have had clearly conservative consequences, clearly positive results. And one of them is the reduction of the top tax rate from 70 to 50%. Now, this actually was we were saved by the Democrats on this one because the Reagan administration was afraid to introduce such a radical proposal. So it was finally introduced by Congressman Obie. But nonetheless, it is part of the general thrust of Reaganomics, and its results are worth considering. And they are, in fact, available today. Because of the drop in the top rate from 70 to 50, all leading econometric models predicted, of course, that the rich would pay much less taxes, that tax payments by the rich would decline. And as a matter of fact, OMB predicted that the decline would be from about $75 billion to $72 billion. And Alice Rivlin had a similar estimate. Other econometric models were around $70 billion. But in general, all the established econometric schemes agreed that revenues from the rich would drop. And this was despite the assumption that during the course of fiscal 82, the recession would end. And in fact, the recession deepened in 1982. So if you assumed that the recession would deepen as it did, these models all would have predicted revenues from the rich of under $70 billion. Well, now the results from 1982 are available. And a fascinating thing happened. Revenues from the rich did not drop. They rose from $76 billion to $85 billion. It was the only, all the places where tax rates rose, revenues were extraordinarily disappointing in 1982, fiscal 82, ending in September. But in the one place where there was a decisive cut in marginal tax rates, there was a flood of unexpected new revenues as the rich moved out of tax shelters into productive investments. And this is the chief reason for this surge, together with the decline in inflation. And so, incidentally, the surge in payments by the rich has accelerated in the first two quarters of 1983. So that you can say that the Reagan administration, contrary to all the results of liberal policy over the last 20 years, has actually achieved a massive increase in the share of the tax burden paid willingly by the rich. And this is, and in other words, contrary to all the theories that further tax cuts would be a giveaway to upper income groups, and one can find such estimates even in the pages of the Wall Street Journal, believe it or not, the front pages, the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal and the front page of the of the Wall Street Journal have virtually no intercommunication at all. So, but anyway, that the same result occurred in England, to the great surprise of the policymakers there. All the tax rates that they raised reduced revenue, and the ones they cut increased revenue. And this of course, is a radical, extreme, peculiar supply-side proposition. But in fact, all the evidence shows that it's true. And regardless of all this evidence, you will find economists persistently saying there's not a shred of evidence to support the more extreme renditions of the Laffer curve. Well, I can't find any evidence that violates those propositions. But I think it's the more you look, the more evidence you find for it. The other conservative idea, which I think is going to have very positive consequences, is the general stress on entrepreneurship as the driving force in the U.S. economy and the crucial force in the introduction of new technologies. Now, in the next couple of years, you're going to be deluged with analyses from the groups that call themselves the Atari Democrats and the high-tech Democrats that industrial policy is needed to foster the introduction of the new technologies on which our future growth depends. And there'll be a lot of citations of Japan, which I think is always rather amusing. Economists really like to believe that a group of economists in the Ministry of International Trade and Industry are actually responsible for the extraordinary achievements of Japanese entrepreneurs. I call it the cock-a-doodle-doo theory of economic growth. The idea that the sunset and sunrise industries, and the idea that sunrise industries loom up on the horizon because a group of economists at the Ministry of International Trade and Industry peel cock-a-doodle-doo. But anyway, this is the general industrial policy theory of economic growth. And I go into Japan at great length in my book about how their economic growth really was launched and sustained. And the interesting fact is that the Ministry of International Trade and Industry had a very small role in that achievement. On the other hand, I'd like to end with a little tale of how economic growth, in fact, does occur in the United States, and how the new technologies still continue to arise. And I'd like to tell just briefly the story of a semiconductor chip called the 64K RAM. That's a random access memory. And it's a chip that essentially quadruples the memory power of all computers in the economy. It's thus a crucial new product as computers proliferate massively. The 64K RAM was sort of the target of all the industrial policies of all the major nations in the world. For example, Japan's government, in conjunction with a group of their leading computer companies, invested some $400 million in research and development designed to launch the 64K RAM. The Germans had a big 64K RAM project. France invested some $4 billion in their famous Plan Calcul, a significant portion of which was devoted to producing a 64K RAM. And the British government invested some $200 million in a startup in Colorado called NMOS in their effort to introduce a 64K RAM. Well, the British project had no results at all to speak of. NMOS is just now beginning to produce the product. France's Plan Calcul has been a complete disaster. IBM still commands 55% of the French computer market, and no French company could produce a 64K RAM. Meanwhile, all the biggest corporations in the United States launched 64K programs, and they all, IBM, Western Electric, all the major computer companies did invest in this project. Texas Instruments, Intel, all the big electronic firms invested about $100 million apiece in launching this product. And early in January, by far the best 64K RAM in the world appeared. And it didn't appear in Japan or France or Britain or even in Silicon Valley. It did not come from any of the major electronic firms in the United States. It came from a tiny startup just 3 years old in Boise, Idaho, called Micron Technology. It was a company that no semiconductor expert would finance. No venture capitalist, no sophisticated firm of venture capitalists would give it any money at all. And it achieved this breakthrough with just $15 million, which is about a tenth of what most of the other companies spent on it. And it achieved this support chiefly from potato farmers and sheep farmers. The key financier of Micron Technology was a man named J.R. Simplot, whose company provides most of the French fries for McDonald's. But in any case, the point about Micron Technology, which now leads the world in the most important of all the semiconductor chips, in the face of the unanimous belief of all the experts that it was impossible for a new company to even build one of these chips, let alone the best in the industry. This seems to me to reaffirm the essential entrepreneurial sources of economic growth in the most demanding and of all modern technologies. And I think this is the crucial thing to understand. As technology proceeds, it does not devolve increasingly on larger companies. Small startups with dynamic entrepreneurs are still the crucial source of economic growth in America. And most of these companies start up in the face of a general belief by the experts that their projects cannot succeed. And since any industrial policy will necessarily rely on the views of the experts, it necessarily will repress the surprising innovations of entrepreneurs that are most crucial to success in the world economy. And I think this very old-fashioned conservative idea continues to have the most radical consequences for economic growth and progress, and I think ultimately will reaffirm the essential themes of the American saga. And I think that my book is full of such stories, but I think this was probably the exemplary one, and does affirm the most central of conservative ideas about the value of freedom and in economic progress. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. By Micron, huh? Where is it listed? That was.
Private.
Oh, too bad. By the way, I don't think I said that the title of George's new book is The Spirit of Enterprise. Thank you, George. What a wealth of knowledge and information. We enjoyed that very much.